Morning. So this morning, I'm going to start by quoting from Case 3 in the Blue Cliff Records. When Gute Osho was asked about Zen, he simply raised his finger. Once a visitor asked Gute's boy attendant, "What does your master teach?" The boy, too, raised his finger. Hearing of this, Gute cut off the boy's finger with a knife. Quiet teacher, huh? The boy, screaming with pain, began to run away. Gute called to him, and when he turned around, Gute raised his finger. The boy suddenly became enlightened. Some of you guys know this, but some of you don't know this story. So, at first take, this story is about not living someone else's life. It's about not living someone else's life. But we spend a lot of our time living other people's lives because we're anxious, we're insecure, we are confused. And when I was at Zen monastery years ago, I noticed, and I was critical of my friends who were imitating my teacher. And you know, he bowed a certain way, and then they bowed a certain way. He shaved his head every 4th or 9th day, and even though they weren't priests, they did it. And then pretty soon, I noticed that they started making the same grammatical mistakes that he made. And then my wife pointed out to me that I was making the grammatical mistakes that he was making. So, well, this is interesting, isn't it? And, of course, when we're insecure, when we're... and we find someone or something that seems more real and more alive, we glom onto it. And we want to live their life. We don't want to live our lives. Our lives suck. Our lives suck, so we want to live their life. So we do this. We do this. And that's interesting, isn't it? So at first take, the story is about the limitation of doing that. The limitation and how we all fall into that trap. But there's another take on this story too, and all these stories have lots of different takes on them. So we could say that that story is about authenticity. It's about authenticity. Gute is the teacher is has come to his own wisdom, has discovered his own wisdom, and he's authentic, and the student's not. The student's groping and unsure of himself and copying. So then the next question is authenticity the gold standard? Moving on to another take to the story. Is authenticity the gold standard? I had a friend who got promoted and at her job. And she's a friend who, she's very self-disclosing. And that's part of who she is. That's authentically. She's developed that probably through years of therapy. Who knows? You know? but she got promoted. Now these people who were her peers are no longer her peers anymore. So they work for her. So she's being authentic with them. She's saying, "Oh, I don't know about this job that I've got. I'm having all kinds of problems." So
they're getting demoralized by her authenticity. So,
so authenticity is tricky, isn't it? It's tricky. In fact, what happened with my friend is that the people who worked for her and worked with her began to lose confidence in her because she was so, quote, authentic, unquote. So, authenticity also can be an excuse for sticking with what's comfortable, with what's familiar, with what we think are who we are. We are. And maybe it's more important to move beyond our comfort zone. When we have the opportunity, move a little ways beyond our comfort zone. Just one step beyond it, even if we're going to possibly fail. And if you do that, you may feel like you're getting your finger cut off. The second cake on the story, right? You may feel like you've got your finger cut off. But what happened when he got his finger cut off? He attained enlightenment. The teacher held up a finger, he attained enlightenment. What if he hadn't been copying? He wouldn't have attained enlightenment. He copied, he imitated. He was inauthentic. He attained enlightenment. Right? He moved beyond his comfort zone. He moved beyond his idea of who he was, who he authentically was. And the attendant is nameless here, but Gute we know a lot about because he's in lots of Blue Cliff records. And this book I've had for 40 years. So it's starting to fall apart. Maybe I should get another version. I imagine it's still around. So Gute, the teacher, there are many stories about him when he was a young student. The teacher who used the one-fingered Zen, right? Many stories about him. And here's one, which some of you know. So Gute was living alone at the foot of a mountain. It was a quiet twilight, a good time for meditation, and Gute had been sitting for a long time in his hut. Outside, the dry fallen leaves were stirred by the winter wind and rustled softly on the ground. The dusk gathered. A new mood shed her dim light. A figure appeared from the dark and silently walked toward the hut. This was the nun Jisai, dressed in the clothes of a traveling priest with a broad hat, black robe, and pilgrim staff. She entered the hut, walked around Gute's seat three times, and then standing straight in front of him, threw her staff down on the ground, saying, "Say a word, and then I will take off my hat." Gute, on this occasion, was at a complete loss for words. Jisai once more walked around Gute's seat three times and again asked her question. Three times she did this, and finding that Gute could still return no answer, she began to leave. Gute said, "It's already dark. Please stay here the night." Jisai replied, "Say a word and I will stay." Gute could say nothing, and Jisai walked out into the night. That night, Gute tossed and turned in his bed, saying to himself, "What a stupid fellow I am," etc., etc. So, when Jisai was, when Gute was a young meditator, he stayed within his comfort zone. It took him many more years to really imbibe the way than it did the attendant. Because here with Jisai, he could have done anything. But he stayed within his safe area. We always want to stay within our safe area. But Zen practice is partly about taking a step beyond your safe, your safety. Not arbitrarily. Not arbitrarily. But openly and courageously. And actually, he could have done anything if she would have stayed the light. He was thinking, he didn't know the right answer. But that's our problem. We're always thinking we need to have the right answer to act,
to be in the world. And we get stuck. We get stuck. So maybe it's the moments that most challenge who we are, who we think we are, our authentic self, that are the most valuable to us. Maybe those are the ones that really give us an opportunity to open up and really participate fully in life, fully.
So, years ago, when I was the first year that I was ordained as a Zen priest here, I went to Colorado, to Boulder, Colorado, to study at Naropa Institute to take courses in Buddhism. And Katagiri Roshi, the teacher here, supported me in doing that, although I did it on my own. And then I came back, and like my first week back, he approached me and he said, "Well, what did you take?" And I said, "Well, I took a history of Buddhism, I took a Buddhist psychology." He said, "Oh, yes, well, now it's time for you to teach it." And I had never given a talk here at Zen Center, or one talk I gave. I didn't like to do public speaking. I didn't go. If he had told me I was. And I didn't think I was a good public speaker. Made me nervous. Made me nervous. But, you know, he asked me to do it. I did it. But it was beyond my comfort zone. And nevertheless, it launched me into beginning to articulate the Dharma in words. And it wasn't comfortable initially. And I actually remember the first night that I did it, he wanted me to do the history of Buddhism. And I thought, well, okay, I'll do the history of Buddhism. I didn't know anything more about the history of Buddhism than, you know, what I learned at Naropa in 2 weeks. Okay, I could do the history of Buddhism. So I did it. And well, the group was, I think, smaller than this. Yeah, smaller than this. I mean, it was just me, maybe half the size. And then afterwards, he didn't make any comment. All he did was straighten out my robes. Because I don't know if you know about priest robes, but my teacher never told us how to wear them. And I wore that all higgledy-piggledy. And he never told me how to wear them ahead of time. He'd just straighten them out. So, how do we learn? How do we really learn? Well, interesting. How do we learn? How do we learn so we can be more pliable, more available, more engaged in the world? Partly by giving up this idea of being true to this little self. Or even this big self that I want to be true to, the Zen teacher self. Give me a break. So, second story about me. So, my wife wanted to go to Guatemala 25 years ago. Kind of me wanted to go, but I remember that she wanted to go to work on our Spanish and to do immersion in Antigua, to do a week of immersion, no English. And I said, okay. I wasn't excited. I'm not. My story is that I'm not good at foreign languages. That's my story, right? That's my comfort zone. I'm not. She's good at foreign languages. You may be good at foreign languages. Moi? No. No. You know, when I say my grandkids are French, and when I say to them I can't speak French in France, they just laugh and they say, "Grandpa, that's not right." So, you know. So I have a reason to believe that I'm not good at languages, don't I? I have a reason to believe that. But, you know, Spanish, I'm interested in it. I did it. And I don't know how many of you have done immersion in languages in other countries, but in Antigua, Guatemala, what they did was they give us one-to-one. I had a one-to-one, 6 hours of one-to-one every day with a guy who didn't, a guy about probably 15 or 16, who didn't speak any English at all. No English. And then I had to go, I get some time with Linda after that, then I'd have to go home to the family who spoke no English. And by the end of 2 hours of talking with this guy, I'd be totally in perspiration, totally. It was a very, very hard, painful experience. And I thought, I'm not making any progress here. Why did Linda get me into this? I'm not Linda. And here I am struggling. We only did 1 week. You know, we were supposed to do 2 weeks, but that was our compromise. We did 1 week. So then at the end of the week, I was just relieved to be done with it. And I think we traveled around. I don't remember. And I thought, I'm not going to let her talk me into anything again that's not, it doesn't resonate with who I am. Right? Who are we? Who are we? That's a great question, isn't it? Who are we? It's deep, but it's also not that deep. You don't have to make it into a big, huge deal. So then I came back, and the next year I was part of a Rotary Club, there was a project in Guatemala helping Mexican refugees who were really having a hard time during the, and I was very, something I was very interested in. So I ended up organizing a group to go down there and go to the border of Guatemala and Mexico from within Guatemala to work with refugees. I did some of the organization, not all of it. And you know what? They started, the guys and the women in the Rotary started talking and saying, well, here's Tim, our translator. And I had breakfast with Bob Parrish 6 months ago, one guy on the trip that I moved with, and he said, yes, you were our translator on that trip. We couldn't have done this without you. And I thought, really? I can't speak any Spanish. But I was their translator. I mean, who are we? If we move beyond who we think we are, you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised what you can do. You'd be surprised. I'm still surprised. We have a group of people who are going to be initiated into our Zen tradition here, and they're sewing right now. They're sewing roksus. This is a roksu. And someone who becomes a priest sews a big robe, and that's our tradition. And when I first was introduced to this many years ago, I thought, well, this is silly. What does this have to do with Zen? Threading a needle? This is not me. I don't darn socks. This is not me. And I can't thread a needle. I don't want to learn to thread a needle. That's not relevant to me as a psychologist, as a father, as a... pretty soon my kids will start asking me to darn their socks. I'd rather not learn. But you know, all learning begins with unnecessary and superficial behaviors. You know, you say to yourself they're unnecessary and superficial. That's where our learning begins. That's where it begins. And you can stay within your comfort zone and don't do any unnecessary and superficial behaviors if you want. But then you kind of freeze. You live a frozen life. And you may be true to yourself, but this is a pretty small, constricted self that's not very happy and not very available. So, maybe there's no one authentic self. Maybe, as Shakyamuni said, they're a collage of selves. A collage. An ever-changing collage. So, I don't know if you've been reading about Margaret Thatcher lately. So I happened to have read about her a few months ago, the revisionist stuff about Margaret Thatcher, who was considered such a, by a, not by me, but by a group of people that, you know, a wonderful political leader. She knew what her ideas were. She was effective in her methods. And she did a lot of things. And she was the first woman to rise to prominence in the UK, in Europe, and she was very effective. But, you know, she was so true to herself that she ended up getting ousted by her cabinet. She was so convinced about the rightness of her ideas and the effectiveness of her methods that she was ousted. And now the revisionists, even the conservatives in the UK, are saying, oh, she wasn't very good for the country. Interesting. She wasn't very good for the country. So in Zen, what we're developing, with some gentleness, I hope, is some adaptivity, some resilience beyond our ideas of who we are. We're trying on different selves. And we can do this playfully, can't we? It doesn't be a big, serious project. I know we seem serious. Of course, it is serious. It's a very serious issue. But we can be light with it. We can be light with it. So my teacher, my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi. Dave, would you mind putting a clock so I can see it? Good, thanks. My first teacher. He went to Montana to a ranch of my friend's parents. There was a student with him, and he came back from Montana, and I picked him up at the airport in San Francisco, and brought him back to the Zen Center. And you know, I was asking him, "Did you have a good time?" "Well, yeah, I had a good time." I said, "What did you do?" He said, "Oh, I rode horses." And he said, "I said, oh, you rode horses? I didn't know you knew how to ride a horse. He said, "No, I didn't know, but the horse knew." The horse knows, you guys. Don't worry. The horse knows. So, a few months later, I saw my teacher after morning sitting, I guess after breakfast, in some little white shorts. Some of you have heard this story before. Little white shorts. And, you know, I'd only seen him in black before. And he's, you know, he's in, but his legs didn't look that good. I'd never really seen his legs before. Anyway, he's in this, and then he's putting on this little white hat over his bald head, little white beanie hat. And I said, "Sensei, what are you doing?" He said, "I'm going to play tennis with Betty Wong." And I said, "Oh, really?" I said, "I didn't know you knew how to play tennis." He said, "No, I don't know, but Betty knows." Betty knows. So we can playfully move beyond our comfort zone, you guys. And you'd be amazed what you can do. I don't mean some heroic thing. I just mean be involved, be engaged by moving beyond your idea of who you think you are, by that limitation that sort of constricts you, rather than the drudgery of working on yourself. Oh. Therapy, 16 years of therapy. 6 years of therapy. You know, I used to be a therapist. Working on yourself. Oh.
Wow. How about adopting a playful attitude? You know, when I then I followed my teacher out to the tennis court. I wanted to see this. I wanted to see this. So he let me go with him. And you know, he was about 4'11". But Betty was about 4'11", too. They were quite a trip together. She was Chinese. And she knew, she did know how to play tennis. And so I watched, but they didn't seem to play very long. And he hit the ball occasionally. He fell over a couple of times. He was giggling the whole time, like he was having the best time in the world. And Betty was liking it too. I mean, she was, you know, when somebody's having a good time falling all over themselves, you know, everybody has a good time, right? So embracing opportunity, developing our own collage of selves. And you think you've got your collage. You don't have it. It's always changing. It's not your collage. It's a collage of opportunities, of experiences, of being with people, of trying things. Just engaging. Just engaging. You know, there's an idea about plagiarism. I have this book coming out it's just a book on all my talks. And what Wanda Isle did is she took talks given over 10 years, and she took themes from my, and she turned into a book. And then she did, I think, a beautiful job, but I pulled open the book and I thought, oh, I thought a lot of, saw a lot of interesting stuff in there. I didn't remember saying it, but and then I thought, oh, that's Suzuki. Oh, there's Katagiri. Oh, there's Jack Kornfield. Oh, there's Dogen. And I could see all the different strands that made up my teaching for all these years. I didn't see all of them, but, oh, interesting collage. And is that plagiarism? Maybe so. Now, if it had just been one, if I had just followed one person and said what they said, it would be considered plagiarism. But the best authors have a multiplicity of teachers, and their words come from everywhere. From their, and they're not considered plagiarists. So you just have one self, one teacher, and you're a plagiarist. You have a multiplicity. You're not a plagiarist. You're just opening up and experiencing, and enjoying, and sharing, giving and taking and sharing. So my advice to you is, don't stick to your story. Don't stick to it. Don't stick to it. Stick to it a little bit if you want to, but not for too long, okay? Not for too long. Not forever. It's just one story among a multiplicity of stories. I mean, what is identity? What is identity? Isn't that a selective appropriation of past, present, and future? So we're selecting something from our past, we're projecting it into the future. But you know, you have a potpourri of experiences from your past. You have a potpourri of experiences. You don't have to be hypnotized by single stories, especially negative ones from your past. They don't have to cast a shadow over your life. So we grow by stretching the limits of who we are. You can become someone who sees impediments as opportunities. You can. You will. You will if you do this practice. Yes, you will. And you'll enjoy trying out new stories. Well, uncomfortable at first, but after a while, cool. And then another uncomfortable one, you know? This comfort never goes away, but not bad. So I want to tell two more stories, and then we'll have a discussion.
So I've been reading also about Victor Havel. Raise your hand if you know who Victor Havel is. Most of you don't. Okay, so he was the first president of Czechoslovakia, the first elected president of Czechoslovakia. And at the White House 2 months ago, they unveiled a bust of Victor Havel, because as the first democratically elected president of Czechoslovakia, he was president at a key time when the Iron Curtain was being dismantled, and he was considered very, very important in the dismantling of the Iron Curtain. And he had a chance to meet with Gorbachev soon after he was elected president. And in his autobiography, he decided that he had this opportunity. He was nervous about it. I mean, Gorbachev, Czechoslovakia is like this, you know, and it's been under the USSR's thumb, starting with Stalin, everybody's thumb, and so he's nervous about it. But he's gonna take this opportunity to treat Gorbachev as an equal, you know, so he moved beyond his comfort zone, and he says, "It occurred to me." Oh, he talks about how he planned for this, and then his meeting with Gorbachev, and then what he actually said to Gorbachev. And here's what he said to Gorbachev: "It occurred to me, after being given the peace pipe, this peace pipe by a Native American leader, that I should bring this pipe to Moscow, and we should smoke it together," he said to Gorbachev. And of course, he was being light. He was being playful, but he was also being engaging. And Gorbachev said, "But I don't smoke." That's the whole story. There's nothing more to that story than that. Nothing more. But if you read about Victor Havel, he was a Zen master. I mean, he was. A few politicians are. Not very many. It's hard to find a politician who is. He had worked as a lab assistant as a young man. Well, then he was a stagehand for a while. Then he was a dramatist for a while. Then he was a moral philosopher. Then he was a political prisoner for 4 years. And finally, he was president for 14 years. So he tried on a multiplicity of selves, didn't he? Multiplicity of selves. And he was incredibly humble. He said, "The lower I am, the more this seems like my proper place. And the higher I am, the more I feel that there's been some mistake." There has been a mistake. And we make mistakes. When we move beyond our comfort zone, some Zen teachers said our lives become one mistake after another. But that's cool. That's not bad. We're opening up. We're embracing. We're engaging. We're not constricting into little Tim or little Ben or little Carrie. And he openly acknowledged his mistakes. He sees his opportunities rather than nursing grievances. He had lots of grievances. He had lots of grievances. The communists had done a number on the Czechs, a big number on the Czechs. But he didn't nurse them. He brought the peace pipe to Gorbachev. And then during the 14 years he was president, no retribution to Czech communists. No retribution. Generosity. Moral imagination. Not sticking to his story. Not sticking to his past hurt. Projecting that forever on everyone. Not doing that. Not doing that. So, last one. It's a short one. So I heard Katagiri Roshi, the teacher here who ordained me, talk once about calligraphy. And I have this in mind because there are two calligraphy pieces that Pamela has just helped me put up in my office. And Well, I won't talk about those. I could talk about those. I'm trying to stay within my time. So. But Bouchot is sitting right there. So let's see, what am I talking about? Oh, I'm talking about Kashmir.
The nature of time.
Oh, the nature of time, yeah. So a long time ago, although it seems as if it just happened, I was sitting in this room listening to my then teacher and now teacher, who was long deceased and yet here, Katagiri Roshi, give a talk. And he was talking about calligraphy. Calligraphy, there's an example. Is that his calligraphy over there? Does anybody know? Probably it is, that piece of calligraphy there. Probably. Does anyone know? Nobody knows. No. Some one of us should know. This is our temple, you know. he said, and Katagiri himself had been doing calligraphy for a long time. He said, if you want to be a calligrapher, he said, practice the style and follow the instruction of one teacher. Just do that. Just practice and follow. Practice and follow. Practice and follow. Comfortable, uncomfortable, fake, authentic. Practice and follow. Practice and follow. And then, he said, move on to a second teacher and practice his or her style and follow his or her instruction. And then when you've done that, and you've completed that, forget both of them. Forget it all, and your calligraphy will be totally alive. Like that piece of calligraphy. Totally alive. So, I think I'd like to close by having you do an exercise. And you can either do the exercise or pretend to do it. It won't make any difference. So let's why don't you all close your eyes and get in a comfortable posture and just do a moment of zazen. A moment of just breathing. Take in a nice deep breath, two or three nice deep breaths. And then let your breath resume to its normal rhythm. And now, bring to the surface of your consciousness, allow yourself to think about a limitation you have. Notice this story or sentence or two sentences about a limitation you have. And just let that story, those phrases about that limitation pass through as you breathe, measure in your body. Stay in contact with your body. Notice your breathing. But let that limitation with its whatever feelings are attached to it, just stay there. Move around. Express itself as it wants to. And just breathe into it. There's no right way to do this. Just see what happens. See what sentences or phrases come up. Feel their limitation, contours. the repetitiveness. And now when you're ready, you can just let go of that and resume paying attention to your breathing. And if the story wants to stick around, let it stick around, but just focus on your breathing. Letting go of everything but just being here. And then when you're ready, you might want to tell yourself a story, virtually the same story that you were just telling yourself, but contradicting it. Telling it in the opposite way. Contradicting the story. Notice how you might contradict it. How you might tell it so that it's open and not limited. What you might say to yourself, and how that feels. Regardless of how awkward and how inauthentic it feels, just being with it. And then notice if there's any memory that arises that supports this contradicted version of what you're telling yourself. And if there's no memory, you might even want to create your own new memory. Because memories are like that. They can just be created. So just take a minute to play with this contradiction of your limitation. Just being with it. Let's just finish off by resuming our normal breathing and letting go of both the story and the counter story, both the limitation and the opening up. Just letting go and coming back to being here and opening your eyes gradually. And gradually turning your attention to the room. So, we do have a little time for questions or comments or whatever. Questions, comments, stories, counter stories. Yeah.
I like that you said just now. You have two options. One is you can do the exercise, and the other one is you can pretend to do it.
Yeah.
You didn't say we can't. You know, we can. Then we can. You didn't say we couldn't do it.
Oh.
I like that.
Okay.
So many times you get. People say it's okay if you don't do it. It's okay if you just, it's okay just the way it is, which is true, obviously. At the same time, it's good to try it.
Thank you. What else? What else, you guys? What does this evoke that you like to put out there?
Surprised by the first story that you shared, where I forget the name, but he didn't say anything to the other person, so then she left and didn't stay the night.
Yeah.
And he regretted that.
Yes.
And I was curious about why would he feel that regret, and Like, what could he really be missing out on?
Right, so, okay, so she's talking about, do you remember, she's talking about the second story I told, which is about Goethe when he was a young man. And so he was in the presence of someone whom he thought was quite deep and quite wonderful. this woman. And he wanted to get a taste of Zen himself, but he didn't feel like although he'd been sitting for some time, he just didn't feel like he'd gotten anything. He felt like he was still a mess, which happens to a lot of people. A lot of people, a story I hear all the time up in my room in one-to-ones is that, Zazen doesn't help. And it doesn't help calm my mind, and so he was feeling that way. He was feeling that way, and she was asking him to express himself. He could have done anything, but he was afraid. He felt not good enough. He felt constricted in the presence of this wonderful teacher, whom he probably put on a big pedestal the way we do people who we think are, you know, more something than us. And so then she left and he regretted he had this opportunity to just kind of really engage with her, and he closed down. So he regretted that. But there's still time. We regret, but there's still time. Later he became a great Zen teacher, so there's always time. There's always time. Does that make sense?
My playful mockery of my father resulted in a much better understanding of who I was when I was angry with
my stepfather. Your playful mockery. Internal mockery?
Then I started to understand what it was that motivated as a result of that. Turned me around. I was no longer hateful. And I started to see myself originally offended by his behavior as from a new point of view, because I could see the motivation from another perspective and the indecency of my reaction to it.
Yes. Oh, good. Thank you for sharing that.
I like the part that you said about the trying on the self, trying on the identity. It reminded me of something going on in that one.
What did you say?
Peeling the identities that itself apart and just sort of leaving them on not. I think that's in the book Albert Golden, I think, it just broke up the last John Lennon. Whatever you think about the book, but I mean, he said he'd peel off layers of self with identity and just put them around the room and look at them.
Interesting. Interesting.
Are you here, Kim?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I was sad to know that, you know, Goethe finger was cut.
He what?
His finger was cut by his guru.
He what?
His finger was cut.
I'm sorry. Can
finger
you?
Finger was cut.
Yeah.
Isn't it against the Buddhism concept?
Well, Goethe is the one who cut the student's finger off. I want to think. I like to think about this metaphorically. Now, whether this literally happened, and obviously that's the way I want to tell the story, because. For me, it's like any time we move beyond who we think we are, there's some pain. There's some pain. I hope his teacher really didn't cut his finger off. But I don't know. If he did, I don't think it was skillful means. So, you know, but that's my take from American 21st century. I think of it as a metaphor.
Because there is a story in the Hindu religion that one of the disciples goes to a guru saying that, I want to become your disciple. And then guru says, what the gift you give to me? Then he says, okay, you ask whatever you want. And then the guru says, do you want to give your finger? Mm-hmm. And the disciple acts of it and discusses the thing that it is with the same letter of his wife. So you need, and he offers that, and that's what the guru, and then he becomes his disciple, and he is supposed to become a big person in the life.
Well, I didn't understand all that. You know, I have a hearing deficit, but I kind of got it. You know, we do have to give ourselves away if we're really going to do this practice. We do have to give everything away at some point. That's only how we begin to groove on this collage of cells, when we give this self away that right now is limited, and the teacher is helping us do this, and always helping us do this, but hopefully in a skillful way, hopefully not based on what he needs, but based on us, hopefully, but sometimes not so skillful. Sometimes we're not so skillful. I make mistakes all the time. Ted has to correct me all the time. It's true. But that's life, isn't it? That's life. All right, well, thank you.